Hello and welcome aboard your maritime programme, Seascapes. On this week's edition, sharks are given protection by the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species. We'll be talking to seafarer, fisherman and lighthouse keeper and recently published author Gerald Butler and his book The Lightkeeper. And you'll have an opportunity to win a copy in our Seascapes competition. There's much activity on the water this weekend, both around our coastline and on the inland waterways. And as usual, Irish Water Safety is appealing to all members of the public to ensure that they wear a well-maintained and correctly fitting life jacket for all water-based activities. You can read more on www.iws.ie. First this week on Seascapes, to one of our most striking seabirds, the puffin. They nest in burrows. Mark Jessop is a marine biologist and a postdoctoral researcher in the Marine Ecology Group at the Coastal and Marine Research Centre at University College Cork, based at the Irish Naval Base in Hall Boland. He did his undergraduate degree in his native Melbourne in Australia and his PhD in Cork. He has worked in the Antarctic on seals, penguins and albatrosses. Seascapes spoke to Mark about his research on the colourful puffins and what numbers we have off our shores and where they are.
Ireland has a population of around about 20,000 breeding pairs of puffins. Half of that population is on islands just off the coast of Kerry, mostly on a place called Puffin Island, which you really can't get a lot of access to. And there's quite a few thousand, around about 3,000 to 4,000 pairs on Great Skellig. And obviously the only way out to get those is by boat. And you're very much restricted by the weather conditions as well, because you get quite bad sea swells off the west coast of Ireland. So we don't know an awful lot about birds breeding out there simply because the access is so difficult. Skellig Michael is a very steep rock straight out of the surface of the sea. You know, there's an old monastic settlement on there as well, and you know, people have quite helpfully built a load of steps in there that need a lot of work every year just to maintain them. But the puffins on Great Skellig are quite used to people. You know, they'll sit there and they'll land right at your feet and peck at your shoelaces when you're around there. But it's very, very steep and very slippery, so it's very difficult to make your way around the colony. So you are very much limited to working on birds that are very close to the pathways and the stairways. Well, most of what we know about the diet of puffins has come from colonies in the UK, Scotland and the northeast of England. And there they tend to eat mostly sand eel. But when sand eel is down in numbers, they'll tend to eat a lot more sprat and herring, that sort of thing. And we believe that the birds around the coast of Ireland are primarily feeding on things like sprat and herring, and to a lesser extent, sand eel. The best way to assess that is to sit in the colony, and these birds actually bring back food to their chicks over the summer when they're rearing them. And you can just see what they bring back to the burrows in terms of what's held in their beaks. So it's easy enough to assess what they're eating. And quite often things like herring gulls and lesser blackback gulls will intercept puffins on their way back to the burrows and make their puffins drop their fish. So if you're quick enough, you can actually get there before the gulls do and pick them up and put them in a bag to identify them later.
Now, one of the most remarkable photographs, I've seen some of Mark Carmody's photographs of puffins with them clutching all those fish in their mouths. But how do you track them then? Because I presume, do you tag them or can you find out their movements?
Well, we recently started a tracking program from the Skelligs. We've been putting out things called geolocators. It's essentially a little clock and a light meter, and it uses the timing of dawn and dusk to calculate a rough position to accurate around about 200 kilometres. So we've put those out over the wintering period when the puffins are no longer on the islands, and we found that these birds from the Skelligs have actually gone all the way to Canada and back over the winter period and spent a lot of their time right in the middle of the Atlantic. So it's quite a journey for a very small bird. And we believe they're eating more zooplankton in that time of the year as well. I mean, they're certainly a very photogenic species. The interesting thing about the puffins is, though, they actually lose those colourful plates on the beak over the winter. So they shed those off and they become a much more sort of dark, dull colour over the winter. So this is their breeding plumage. That's what they do as their display to attract a mate and, you know, and raise their chicks. And then they all fall off over the end of the summer. The puffins will tend to have one egg, one chick over the breeding period. And on average, you'd say around about 80% of those chicks would actually survive to fledging or, you know, through their teenage years and go out to sea by themselves. In terms of the population trends, we believe they're relatively stable. I mean, there was certainly a very large decline from the early 1900s when there were thousands and thousands all over the place. Now that the larger colonies are limited to maybe 4,000 or 5,000 birds or individuals, but censuses haven't really been done frequently enough to actually gauge population trends. We had a large census for all of Ireland in 1970, another one in 1988, and another one in 2000. So, you know, 3 points on a line doesn't really make for a good population trend, but we're due to get more monitoring in the next couple of years. One of the reasons, or the thought of reasons for the decline on places like the Salty Islands, is the introduction of rats there. And, you know, puffins can't really go anywhere when they're cornered in a burrow. So, you know, the rats will target chicks. They're also targeted by things like greater black-back gulls, and they take the chicks as well when they're quite young. And the other reason that we think that the populations might be sort of more declining is changes in food availability. But without in-depth tracking studies, and we don't know exactly where these birds are going to get their food, it's difficult to know, you know, how that prey changes are actually affecting the population. So there's certainly a lot more work to be done. Well, we certainly get some amazing bird populations in Irish waters, you know, and we get birds that travel between, say, Ireland and Europe all the way across to North America and up into Greenland. So we've got some species that are very well adapted to these sort of cold, temperate climates. In Australia, a lot of our bird species, you know, would be adapted to much warmer temperatures, although we do get the occasional albatrosses that come up from the Southern Ocean, and we get those in sort of southern Australian waters as well, but, you know, much, much larger than anything we'd get here.
But I'm sure people listening to this now will be intrigued to hear about your description of the fact that some of our puffins can be found out right in the heart of the Atlantic, and also making those extraordinary journeys, because it's not something we know that much about them.
No, there were some tracking studies done in the northeast of England and Wales where they put similar geolocator devices on the birds. And a lot of their animals, they either went into the North Sea or they did venture out into the Atlantic, but nowhere near as far as the birds from Ireland did. So they're certainly breeding them a lot tougher out here, and they're making much longer journeys. But, you know, this is something that's only come to light in the last year or two. So we need to do further tracking studies and see if this is consistent year on year, because puffins can change their behaviour every now and then, you know, depending on where prey resources are available. So we'll see if they do this consistently year on year. We're working with the Office of Public Works, who maintain the Skelligs as a site there, and they've given us access over the past couple of years. Now, last year, in conjunction with the Zoological Society of London, we put another 25 tags out on birds, and we're hoping to get those back either in June or July this year, so that'll give us a lot more information about another year's worth of data. And then we're planning on deploying camera traps around some of the burrows, and that essentially just automatically takes a photograph of puffins as they go in and out of their burrows, and we're going to use that to assess how often the parents are coming in to feed their chicks over the breeding season, what sort of food they're delivering, how frequently they're delivering food, to give us a lot more information about the health of the marine area. Technology has played a huge part in what we've been able to do. Some of my earlier work, I was putting satellite tags on albatrosses in the Southern Ocean, and those tags weigh around about 20 grams, which is far too heavy to put on a small seabird like a puffin. The geolocators we've been deploying are only 1.5 grams. They're absolutely tiny, so we know that they're not going to have too much of an impact on the birds, you know, in terms of carrying them around for the year. And then again, you know, we've now got a lot of technology and computer programs that we can do great animations of where the animals are going, and we can make that available to the general public. And in particular, places like the Skelligs, where a lot of tourists go out to see the puffins, it's really great to be able to show the maps of where they go and disseminate this information. Otherwise, there's not really any point in us doing it.
So it must be quite a challenge trying to put a tag on an albatross.
They're amazing, amazing birds, but in a lot of respects, they're one of the most stupid birds. They don't really remember what's been done to them. So, you know, you can go up and catch it and put a tag on it, and it gets all antsy and starts clapping away at you. And then, you know, you'll leave it away for a week or something, and it'll come back with its tag, and you'll walk up to it and will sort of give you a look as though, I think I recognise you from somewhere. And then by then you've caught it again, and it's too late, and goes, ah, that's it. And you get the tags off. But they're a very good species to work on, particularly because they're so big and so broad, and, you know, and they travel such large distances. They're amazing.
Isn't that it? They do travel such large distances, whatever about the size and the makeup of our puffin. But the albatross are quite remarkable in the fact that they'll cover those distances that they cover.
Yes, certainly. The British Antarctic Survey, who I did some work with, they put geolocators on some of their albatrosses, and over the course of 2 years, they actually circumvented the entire Antarctic continent twice. You know, they travelled an immense distance, but, you know, they don't have to flap their wings as often as a puffin. They can do a lot of thermal gliding. Puffins have got a very high energy expenditure when they fly. You know, they fly a bit like a wind-up toy. They're very, very fast wing flapping, and they make a nice whirring sound as they go. So the cost of flight for a puffin is actually quite high, and therefore, you know, the distances they travel, those large distances, probably cost them a lot more than something like an albatross would.
What got you started? What lit the flame?
Well, I grew up in Australia very close to the sea, and you know, we've always had a very close connection with the sea. You know, I was always down there on the beach fossicking around in rock pools, and you know, I've just been very lucky that my career has enabled me to keep, you know, being a child, walking around the beach and playing with things. You know, I love it. You know, I wouldn't do anything else. We're part of University College Cork, and we're based down on the Irish Naval Base at the moment, and we're due to sort of get a new building somewhere down near the Naval Base as well that brings in together a load of different research institutes. But, you know, it's a multidisciplinary research group. You know, I'm part of the Marine Ecology Group, and we do work on anything from things like puffins and gannets to grey and harbour seals, sharks and jellyfish. You know, we've got quite a small group, but we certainly do a wide range of different things down there. And then the centre also has different groups in terms of marine policy and governance and remote sensing and GIS work as well. So, you know, there's quite a lot of people down there working on very different aspects of marine and coastal geography and ecology. We get amazing wildlife in Irish waters. You know, we get all sorts of things that you wouldn't normally see in a lot of other European countries. So we get things like leatherback sea turtles, we get basking sharks, we get whales, we get loads of dolphins and porpoises, loads of seabirds, gannets, puffins, razorbills, guillemots, really exciting animals to see. And you don't have to go that far to see them. You know, you don't even have to get on a boat to see some of these. You know, you can see puffins from the cliffs of Moher. You can see guillemots and razorbills from the same sort of area as well. So, not in as great a numbers, and the colony sizes are a bit smaller, but you know, you can certainly see them quite happily from the coast without having to get on a boat and get yourself seasick. Well, the most surprising thing we did find was how far they went. You know, based on the previous tracking studies in the UK, we thought they'd go into the Atlantic. You know, we didn't have a problem with that, but we never thought they'd go all the way across to Canada. Now, the timing of when they arrive over there seems at the moment to coincide with when you've got large shoals of capelin coming in shore to spawn. So it might be that they're going all the way over there to take advantage of this seasonally abundant prey, but we obviously need to do a little more work before we can, you know, put the nail in that. So we'll need to know whether that's being done consistently year on year before we can start making those sort of generalisations. But, you know, it's early days yet.
Marine biologist Mark Jessop, based at the Coastal and Marine Research Centre at University College Cork. Massive container ships called Triple E ships are forcing ports around the globe to grow to accommodate them. Back in 1998, the maximum capacity on container ships was 5,000 containers. New ships carry 18,000 containers, enough to fill a train over 68 miles long. The ships are described as being almost a quarter of a mile long, taller than a 20-storey high office building, and wider than a motorway. No port in North or South America or the Panama Canal can take these vessels. They can, however, squeeze through the Suez Canal, and they will trade between Europe and China. In Britain, the ports of Felixstowe and Southampton can take these vessels. However, a new port, 20 miles east of London, called London Gateway, which is being funded by Dubai's DP World, London Gateway is due to open at the end of this year and is a massive construction project employing over 2,500 workers. It's likely to bring over 30,000 jobs to that area near London. Perhaps we'll see the same in Foynes on the Shannon Estuary. The Marco Polo is the world's largest container ship at present, with a capacity of 16,000 containers. The world-renowned Maersk Line, the Danish shipping company, has ordered 20 Triple E's from South Korean shipbuilder Daewoo. Maersk have an existing fleet of over 500 vessels. Hard to believe that the original container ship, a converted Second World War oil tanker, and used by the inventor of the metal box, American businessman Malcolm McLean, that vessel carried 58 containers. We have a note in from Seascapes listener Morris E. Withers. He says, if you should like to visit Apollo Dock and select classic yachts, you'll find at the top of the list of classics for sale a 1920s Dublin Bay Oyster Smack, for sale for £500. She appears to be in poor condition as reflected by the price, but I'm sure there are not too many of these old-timers around. I think she's lying on a mud berth at Shoreham, and it appears the owner wants to let her go as he's picking up big moorings bills. It would make a great restoration project for an Irish boat enthusiast. That note from Maurice Withers, Royal Cape Yacht Club and Royal North of Ireland. Next here on Seascapes, to a man who was born in Castletown Bear and whose family are steeped in the traditions of the Commissioners of Irish Lights. He served on Bull Rock, Old Head, Mizzen, Rowan Carrig, Skellig Michael and the iconic Fastnet. He is Gerald Butler and he's author of The Lightkeeper with Patricia Hearn, which is published by the Liffey Press. What, we wondered, was it like being a lightkeeper on an Irish lighthouse?
There was never anything about what we did, how we passed our time, what we got up to when we were on the rocks. Hardly even anything about the duty that we spent, the work content. We did work 8 hours out of our day, 2 4-hour shifts, and we had the rest of the time off, and you had to pass that time out on a rock. So, yeah, that was never documented in any way. A lightkeeper, when you landed on the rock, you got settled into it and you could be on watch straight away the minute you landed. You might just walk into your watch. And, well, in daytime the watch was simple enough. It was just basically to keep an eye out for fog. If weather conditions were good, everything was fine. If conditions were dodgy, well, you just keep an eye on the fog. If it closed in to under 3 miles, we started sounding the foghorn. So your watch then would last for 4 hours. As well as that, in some lighthouses, the watch, we had a light watch and a fog watch. The light watch consisted of your back in the olden days, when it was a paraffin vapour burning light, you lit the light, kept it burning all night. You had to pump up air pressure to 60 pounds of pressure. We had to keep the lens revolving. It's quite a big machine. A lens can be a couple of ton weight. It could be from 2 ton. At Galleyhead, it's a 2 ton lens. And at the old one, gone now from the Bull, was about 8 ton weight. I'm not sure what the one in Dunleary is, but that's another couple of ton weight as well. And those lens were floating in a bath of mercury. And once they were underway, it required very little energy to rotate them. So it was possible to rotate these with a weight-driven clockwork motor. All we had to do was govern the speed of the weight going down through the lighthouse. Unfasten it, it is one flash every 5 seconds. There were 4 lenses, so 20 seconds revolution would give you the flash. Galleyhead next to it had 5 flashes every 20 seconds. It was group flashing. And again, it was the exact same speed, 20 seconds for a revolution. And they're the things we'd have to watch, make sure that that was working. It took the weight a half an hour to go to the bottom. We would have to winch that back up again. And as well as that, keep a watch to see as well. We had oil tanks. We had oil stores. And every year, down on the southwest coast, the Iarne or the Atlanta, they're the ships, the tender ships the Irish Lights had, they would come to the rock and land the oil in barrels. So we would give maybe a couple of days just landing the oil by lifting it up on the derricks, storing it on top of the landing pads or whatever. And then when the ship was gone, we would start taking the barrels of oil off up. We'd have to winch them way up to the top of the rock and pump them into our storage tanks. When all that was done, we would then have to get the empty barrels and store them back down on the landing. Whenever the ship would be coming again, we would return the oil barrels to them. We had to lash the barrels down onto the pad in order, when they were empty, in order that they wouldn't be whipped with the wind, you know.
You grew up first on Galleyhead and then went to Ballycotton when you were the age of 2. Tell me a little bit about that time, because you write about it vividly in the book.
I was born, of course, in Castletown Bear, and when as babies, my father was transferred from Roan Carrig to the Galleyhead. Now, the Galleyhead was a land station and we had the dwelling houses beside the lighthouse. My mother's father was the principal keeper at Galleyhead. And the way the Irish lights worked, it was very, very traditional. A lot of the sons of light keepers would follow on in the same footsteps. The reason that the Irish lights loved this kind of thing was we knew what lay ahead of us. We knew what we were letting ourselves in for. And training lads to be light keepers cost a good bit of money. And the Irish lights did not want to be training fellas and then find that, sorry, this is not for me, I'm gone. And though that did happen, they wanted to hit it as close to right as they could every time. So that's why it became a very traditional type of a job, or I shouldn't really call it a job, but anyhow, a lot of lads from Castletown Bear knew what the Irish lights were about and they came into the Irish lights. A lot of lads from Valentia and from around the Hook area, and, you know, that was the way it worked up. A lot of lads from up in Donegal, they would all have had an interest in it because they'd have seen it, they'd have had some knowledge of it, and they would have come in that way, you know. It's not everybody was up for living out on a rock. Not everybody could handle that. It was very, very isolated. You'd be alone quite a lot, even though there were three keepers on the rock at any one time. Nonetheless, your watch keeping and a lot of your leisure time would be spent on your own. And you needed to be able to be good in your own company. You needed to be able to pass time. You needed to be able to read, be creative, you know, whatever suited, whatever you really liked. It gave great opportunity to follow your passions, I have to say.
So what was it like as a young boy growing up in what was really, I suppose, you probably felt like you were a pirate out of Robinson Crusoe?
Yeah, growing up on these places, when we grew up, particularly at Minehead near Dungarvan in County Waterford, and as well at the Galley, we were out on a headland, and the freedom and the adventure that we, Edmund, my twin and myself, that we enjoyed was absolutely fantastic. As kids, I am so thankful, when I look back on it, that I was born into that life, that I was given all that opportunity, just to go exploring, climbing, fishing, swimming, boating, diving, having all that kind of excitement and fun, you know.
Let's go back to growing up there. It's hard not to have a love of the sea when you're that close to it, as you say, whether it's down in Dungarvan or whether it's down in Galleyhead in West Cork. Inevitably, obviously, in the late 60s, you decide to go and work in with the Commissioners of Irish Lights. Was there ever any doubt that that's what you were going to do?
There was never any doubt, absolutely never any doubt. From when I was a young child, I had never envisaged being anything other than a light keeper. And it's all I ever wanted to do. It was an ambition that I fulfilled, and regretfully left it with redundancy. But nonetheless, delighted to have had the opportunity to do it, I must say. Growing up on these places was fantastic, particularly for a boy. Of course, I'm a twin, and so that doubled up on the fun. Every waking moment we had was spent down at the edge of the cliff. We were either looking for if it was suitable to go fishing. We were making fishing gear. We were either climbing the cliffs in the wintertime looking for wreckage that would have been washed in. All of that kind of thing. And of course, our neighbour at Minehead, Lord of Mercy on Pa, he's dead and gone now, Pa Crowley. And Pa had a .22 rifle. I don't know, was it 20 bullets or something it would take? It was a magazine on it anyway, to take an absolute huge amount of bullets. And we used to go shooting with Pa in the evening along the cliff. I mean, you must remember, we were kids now, 12, 13, 14, as wild as you can imagine. And to be off with this man, he was just like a real older, bigger brother to us, and of the same mentality, I might say, because what we were up for or he was up for, it was all the same thing. And it was absolute fun, real fun. My twin brother, from maybe the age of 16, 17 on, he wanted to become a farmer. And we worked with Neely O'Donovan near us there when we were kids on his farm. And that's where he got bitten by the bug to be a farmer. And he stayed with it. It was his ambition. He came into the Irish Lights. It wasn't suitable for him. Even though we had listened to the same words, we were never, ever apart. Nonetheless, that life was not for him. And he finally did manage to buy a farm. So what you're saying is correct. If you stay with it, a way will be found.
We'll have more from Gerald Butler on Seascapes next week on the Fastnet, Skellig Michael, and his encounter with Olympic swimmer Mark Spitz in the 70s. You can win a copy of The Lightkeeper, courtesy of irishbooksdirect.ie. The question is, name the publisher of Gerald Butler's memoir, written with Patricia Ahern. Answers on a postcard to Seascapes, RTE Radio 1, Father Matthew Street in Cork, or you can email us on seascapes@rte.ie. Next Friday night on Seascapes, more from The Lightkeeper and Gerald Butler, and an opportunity to win a copy courtesy of irishbooksdirect.ie. From Inishmore, Alwyn Gill will have the latest from the islands and that proposed fish farm development. David Dinsmore, editor of Irish Angler, on the latest edition. And we visit the Seascapes archive and hear from Rourke Bryan, Ordeal by Ice, Ships of the Antarctic. All that and much more until next Friday night here on Seascapes, Tightlines and Fair Sailing.